I had sort of a top and bottom question for Mr. Losier. At the bottom, in the last time there was this mass eviction in the 1930s, people were organized by the labor movement, the Wobblies in particular, and would go to evictions, wait until the sheriff's people took the property out and put it on the sidewalk, and then simply take it and put it back in. And they would do this repeatedly. Is this something that could work, even though it's probably now a felony? Is this something that could work in Chicago? And at the top, it's reported that the state attorney general is joining with other state attorney generals in suing banks for total fraud and outrageous behavior in perpetrating completely unviable loans. Is there any way that this can help the grassroots movement that you're working with?
I'll start from the top and work my way down, right? Your question, I think it can both hurt and help the sort of grassroots work that's taking place, because there's a certain degree to which we were in the midst of this robo-signing scandal back in the fall, where it was revealed pretty absurdly that major banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo had contracted with these law firms to process thousands of foreclosure documents, and do so where they weren't even they were committing massive amounts of fraud to the degree to which they were signing affidavits that were not even true, right? And there was a moment where it was so bad that the banks themselves were like, we need to stop all these evictions because we don't know how, we need to stop and take a look at sort of how deep the rabbit hole goes. And while that was happening, there was a moment where all 50 attorney generals got together and said, okay, we got this, right? Don't worry about it. We'll take care of this. And I think that's really dangerous to the degree that I think even though a lot of people have forgotten about that, are sort of working with a sense that, okay, the process, the legal system that helped facilitate this stupendous fraud that's been taking place is going to sort of self-correct that same fraud. And the system is going to sort of work itself out. So I think that's problematic. I think it's even problematic in terms of just sort of sitting on our hands and waiting to see what the attorneys general will do, in part because there's rumors that whatever settlement they're working out, they're not actually interested in sort of prosecuting the banks, but working out some sort of settlement, a settlement that's going to sort of be minuscule in regards to the amount of pain and suffering that's been caused. So, I think that's a big danger. What I think could be a useful opportunity is the degree to which if folks are paying attention to what's taking place, you know, that can be a target and a focus of people's attention. In fact, one of the families that we've been working with, the anti-eviction campaign has been working with, and has gotten actually a family that was facing eviction and is now in renegotiation with their bank to get a modified loan that's not an adjustable rate mortgage, that doesn't have their property that's valued at $400,000 when the actual real market value is somewhere around like $110,000, right? That same family, now that they're on this high of, you know, this success, is what they want to continue to do actions on the bank that was looking to foreclose on them. And they've actually called for a national day of action against HSBC, which is a bank that was looking to evict them. And because there's no HSBC branch in Chicago, are actually organizing a rally outside of Lisa Madigan's office on February 28th at 11 a.m. So for all you, we're more than welcome to attend. February 28th is the day that HSBC's earnings reports come out. So that's sort of the reason for this National Day of Action. But this is something that they took upon themselves and said, you know what, we want to have a protest at HSBC. We want to do it in conjunction with friends in Los Angeles and New York because we can't find an HSBC bank in Chicago. And why don't we do it at the Attorney General's office since there's no HSBC bank? So the degree to which we can sort of take advantage of these moments and sort of be creative about it is I think, really powerful. And it kind of gets to your first question, the bottom part of it, which is a sort of a tactical question. I think the danger, one of the limitations that we found when we did that, when we were doing eviction blockades in Cabrini, is we found that rather than putting people's stuff out on the street, what happened in Cabrini is we'd see people's units just get boarded up, and they would just have to make an arrangement with their stuff still in it, and they would have to make arrangements for the management company to go back in at some point later on and get their belongings, right? And we haven't really seen instances where people have just been evicted to the street, because by and large what happens is people evict themselves. People who are facing foreclosure will just sometimes you get people who just get the court summoned, say, my time is up, excuse my language, and will leave and even do so before their time has run out in court or even before the court process has wound its way through the system. The thing has wound its way through the system. So that's not a tactic necessarily that's we've been able to apply, just because it's not the sort of dynamic that we're dealing with. And we have to find tactics that fit to the situation that we're in right now. One thing that has been, proposed by a number of different groups and hasn't really been applied successfully here in Chicago has been actually the question of taking the tens of thousands of people that are homeless and putting homeless people into homes that are vacant. And we have tens of thousands of people that are homeless in shelters and so forth. And we also have tens of thousands of people who are like technically homeless, but are staying on people's couches, sort of doubling up in apartments and so on and so forth, because they've already either been evicted from where they lived or their home has been foreclosed on. So finding ways to, finding tactics that really fit to the situation that we're in right now is sort of one of the things that we've been wrestling with.
Well, mine is more of a comment, and just looking at the events in Egypt, one of the brilliant things for those of us who are all political activists, and I think pretty much everyone here is that it shows the kind of sweeping changes that we think are necessary are actually possible, not that Egyptians have won their fight. Then the real question is, if we're going to try and replicate that example, both in our own local organizations or on a more sweeping level, say like up in Wisconsin, what is it that the Egyptians did that allowed them to get to the point that they are now? Not that they've won the entire battle by any stretch of the imagination. And I think that's the sort of thing that we need to look at if we're talking about, well, which way forward for us here? And I think there are two prime elements, not that people had this well thought out before they went out into the streets. In fact, one of the first Egyptian solidarity demonstration I went to, one of the speakers, who is Egyptian himself, basically, it was clear that he was perpetually sighing over the condition of non-activity of his fellow Egyptians for decades before this and thought, oh, they'll never do anything. And all of us who are political activists can say that about the United States, and clearly that's a wrong point of view to have. The question is, how did they get to that point? And I think there are two main elements, not that it was thought out before they got to where they are, but one was the political independence from the established forces, regardless of party, that ran society, that this was truly from the bottom up that this came. And the second element was, and I think you can see this in each of the elements of your work that you're doing, and the reason why you are on the panel, is the people were doing it for themselves, however modest a scale that might be, given the resources, people-wise, et cetera, that we have at our disposal. But those were the two keys that allowed them to get to the point where they needed to be. And it's when you can have tons of people behind you, but if you're tied to the established political order, you will be sold right down the river, which, to be brutally frank, I think we can see happened with a huge wing of the immigrant rights movement in this country, the Dream Act and so forth. And that's not unique to the immigrant rights. But you look at what is it going to take for the people of Wisconsin to win? I think we have to be very clear. It's not just the brilliant activity of the people taking over the Capitol building, but it's maintaining the political independence of that movement despite the best efforts of the Democrats, who are carrying out their own budget cuts in the place where they control things. That those two keys we have to see is the way forward for each of our small organizations and hopefully building movements here in Chicago.
Andy's completely right. The advantage in Egypt is that they didn't have the Democratic Party. You know, that's exactly our problem, because what's the solution for Wisconsin? Let's suppose, let's wild dream. Okay, the Republican governor gets defeated and he resigns because there's a statewide strike for 17 days, you know, to break the record, for 17 days. So who's going to replace him? A Democratic governor? Damn. Then what are we accomplishing? Pretty much nothing. So the advantage in Egypt was that the popular movement was not following the lesser evil. You know, they were opposed to government as such. And that's what we don't have here. You know, pretty much widely speaking, we don't oppose all government. We only oppose the Republicans and we support the Democrats. And that's precisely our problem. You're right. The failure of the immigration movement was that everybody lined up behind the Democrats instead of preparing, you know, to go through alternative ways. That's the big problem we have here. What we need is to break once and for all with the Democratic Party. Stop presenting the lesser evil alternative and really get together and create an alternative.
One of the things that, so part of what the campaign looks to do is we go out and we canvass for homes, people who are going through foreclosure, and then we have them come to a community meeting that we're holding. And part of the community meeting is a sort of a legal workshop where folks who don't have legal representation can sit down and talk to a lawyer who deals with foreclosure cases. But part of it is also just a question of informing people about the law and the way that the way the foreclosure process works, right? So that people know sort of what stage they're in and sort of what their options are. One of the things that it's kind of like a popular education session, and that's why sort of informing people of their rights is so important. But part of the sort of stickiness of it too is that we also have to wrestle with the fact that the law is not on our sides, right? The law is on the side of the people who want to take away people's homes, right? And it's sort of set up to legitimate that and make that operate sort of as smoothly as possible. And so while we educate people about their rights, we also have to sort of raise people's consciousness to the degree that we have to kind of go beyond the rights that are just sort of set for us on paper. And one of the things that sort of we picked up from folks in South Africa is sort of understanding that we need to, as you said, create our own media and not just rely on sort of corporate media, but even alternative media sometimes, right? And really put the tools in the hands of those who are sort of at the coalface of the situation to be in the process of making their own media, and to use that as a way to sort of build more broadly, build more democratically, and sort of alternatively as well.
Very good presentations. I'm very interested in all of them. I definitely see the theme across all three of them. One of the things I'm interested in is, it seems to me that if you read like Naomi Klein's book on disaster capitalism, this idea that creating crises is a way of sort of centralizing authoritarian power. And so the same thing, we create this, I'm an economist, so I can tell you that the signs of the housing crisis were obvious to me from early on. And I think anybody who studied economics had a pretty good idea, and people who studied finance knew that this was a scam that was going on. So to try to claim later that it was these homeowners that were just taking advantage of bankers left and right is just absurd. So, but I'm also interested in, because this mode of creating authoritarian power seems to go back to the early 20th century, and they've been learning, they've been getting better at it, I think. So when you said that 15% of these are criminals, and but that's the 15% of their drug dealers, I think we also have to keep in mind that the drug war itself, when they lost the prohibition of alcohol, they again created a threat. They created a crisis in intoxicant use, and they used that to create centralized authoritarian power. And so I'm also interested in what Michael Deutsch was saying, and I'm wondering how much Supreme Court review has happened of these, like these grand jury things, which I didn't realize it was as bad as it you made it sound. And what else? And of course this this latest case that's hasn't even been heard yet, I guess.
It has been heard.
It has been heard.
That Holder case was decided by the Supreme Court in June. That's the law now. And as far as grand juries go, pretty much the fiction is that the grand jury is entitled to every person's evidence, and therefore the grand jury's power has been exponentially expanded since the 50s. At one time, there was this idea that you didn't have to tell, your Fifth Amendment right trumped the requirement to testify, because it wasn't just self-incrimination, it was your privacy rights, it was your political relationships, and you didn't have to testify. But over the last 50 years, that has been totally wiped away, so that is very little rights you have vis-a-vis the grand jury. And the Supreme Court has done away with that from over the last 50 years.
I've got a question for Michael Deutsch. If my understanding is correct, there's a slight difference between civil contempt and criminal contempt. And that difference is that criminal contempt requires a heightened degree of disrespect for the court. But it sounds like in the case of a grand jury, all they have to do is just say, well, we're just going to make you criminal contempt this time.
Exactly. Precisely. You don't have to have any bad intent. The fact of refusing to testify before a grand jury can be designated either civil contempt or criminal contempt. And there's no difference, essentially, other than one is the fiction is you hold the keys to your own freedom in civil contempt. So if you're sent to jail for not testifying, one day you could then change and say, okay, now I'm going to testify, and you'll be released from jail. But if you're found in criminal contempt, it's like any other crime. You're given a fixed sentence, and you go to prison. You cannot change and say, well, now I'm going to testify.
Did they have you in criminal contempt the first time?
Yes. 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 They usually don't, but they could, yes. And people who have held in civil contempt come out of jail after serving their time for civil contempt, and then subpoenaed again and refuse, and then charged with criminal contempt. And I've had clients that have experienced that, political clients.
Thank you, thank you.
Okay, our next questioner will be Ray Parrish.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about collective ownership of property. That's one of the things that I do veterans counseling here in Chicago. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to do, is to come up with ideas, because so many of the veterans are homeless, and a lot of them have this good old GI Bill mortgage guarantee that they can avail themselves of, but they just don't have the physical or the mental capabilities to really be a homeowner, to take care of the property. So it occurs to me that this might be one of the solutions, is we actually tap into the government's money to find some way through a veteran to help those people who are being foreclosed or evicted.
So just to clarify, are you saying that one of the things, are you asking to what degree can the possibility of like collective ownership of housing help out people who are going through foreclosure?
Yeah, just in general, if there's some way of, I understand there's co-ops, that cooperative housing arrangement that Is there some way of taking a foreclosed property, stopping that legal process, and substituting a collective ownership, a cooperative ownership, for that one person, that one family that can't make the bills by themselves, but in cooperation with several other people might be able to come up with that mortgage?
So I haven't seen anything along those lines just yet, but that doesn't mean it's not a possibility. The sort of model that we've been using here in Chicago as a way to reach out to and organize families going through foreclosure borrows off of what friends of ours have done in Boston, where law school students canvass the homes of people who are going into foreclosure. Grassroots organization helps to organize together and actually work with a community bank, a nonprofit community bank, to buy back the mortgage if somebody is going through foreclosure. And they actually have been really successful in doing this after people have been foreclosed on, and they're basically like, look, you actually have more rights. And because the law works a little bit differently in Massachusetts, they're like, look, you have more rights after your home has been foreclosed on. then we hit the bank, then we stall things legally, and we make an offer through this nonprofit bank for you to get out of your adjustable rate mortgage and get a fixed rate mortgage. You know, there's some issues with it and the details and so forth, but I don't see why the sort of resale of the mortgage that happens and that people have been able to achieve in different parts of the country couldn't happen in a collective ownership model. There's also at some point there might also be questions around sort of a community land trust as a way to collectively own homes within a given sort of geographical area, particularly if there's a number of homes that have been lost to foreclosure and that are now vacant, right, because the previous owners have been evicted. there's a law professor that has been in conversation with in D.C. who's going to be coming to Chicago and is interested in working with particularly tenants to work with them to take their buildings co-op if the building is in foreclosure, to basically organize tenant associations in that building and to cooperatively bid on the ownership of an apartment building that's going into foreclosure, which is actually pretty important because as bad as things are in Chicago, the way I just described, that situation, this crisis is actually hitting renters at a higher rate than it is homeowners. And this crisis has actually been one that's significantly undercut the stock of affordable housing because a lot of the properties that have the majority of the housing units that have gone into foreclosure are actually apartment rental units rather than they are sort of single family home ownership units, and it's undercut sort of affordable housing that's available. So this.
Thank you all for the presentations. After listening to the three such very cheerful presentations, I think the theme of the conference ought to be changed from which way forward to how the heck do we stop going backwards. Right. But that would be progress in and of itself. I just wanted to kind of follow up. Despite, you know, the grounds for pessimism, I actually have heard some good things about moving forward. We've heard about independent media, independent political action. All of it's very important. I'd like to just mention the possibility that we also need to think about getting serious about independent labor organizing and activism. Because, you know, if we want to talk about affordable housing or low-income housing, how about raising people's incomes so that they can afford the housing that exists, which implies labor action? And we talked about Egypt. Well, what was it that got them where it hurts is when they started looking at the the economic power of the people that support the political regime. I just want to remind people about that part of the equation, which can also dovetail into schemes for community ownership and worker ownership of facilities and so on. So I just wanted to mention that. I don't know if anyone has a comment on that, but you know, Chicago is a union town. We have a base to begin with, and if we recognize the kind of power that labor potentially has, i.e. Republic Windows, maybe that's something to build on for moving forward.
I was just going to... Oh, yeah.
No, pretty quickly, we've been trying to push for an idea which we call the Horizontal Labor Union, or the Neighborhood Labor Union. Instead of the traditional labor union that organizes workers in this factory, a more open labor union that organizes people in the community, organizes the communities where the members of the labor union live. So it's a labor union that fights for your wages in the workplace, but at the same time for better schooling in your neighborhood, for the transportation in the neighborhood where these workers who are members of the labor union live. So we call this horizontal labor unions, and it's we can, you know, discuss it and debate it for a good couple hours, and we should. But that's something we are pushing forward.
I was just going to say there was a really interesting piece on Democracy Now! On Friday about the degree to which young people have gotten a lot of attention in the uprising that's taking place in Egypt, but a key aspect of it has been sort of working class struggle and sort of shop floor agitation that's been going on for years now, and how in a way a lot of that shop floor agitation has really sort of led the way in the creation of a number of different independent trade unions in Egypt, has really led the way in creating the conditions right now for the uprising against Mubarak. And even the youth movement that's gotten the most attention, the April 6th youth movement, which has sort of been looked at as sort of like the lead player in terms of the fight against Mubarak, was actually created in solidarity with a textile workers' strike that happened, I think it was in 2004, in a like an industrial town sort of north of Cairo. And it's really that fight back at the shop floor level that kind of helped propel forward a lot of the agitation against the sort of totalitarian way things were operating in Egypt.
I have just a very technical question for Michael, and then some of the thoughts. But so the State Department deems which organizations are terrorist. My question is, if you give some support or advocacy for an organization that is then later termed terrorist, can they come after you?
No. Material support, they're not on the list.
They're not that Kafkaesque yet.
Come on the list later. No, they couldn't do that.
Yeah, okay.
It's not retroactive.
Right.
Yeah, not retroactive, okay. It's just, a couple of things that I've been thinking about tonight is the degree to which we can collectively organize is the degree to which we're not isolated. And so many of the struggles, you're right, they are individuated, and whether it's foreclosure or joblessness, they're stigmatized. And so, and just by the very definition of losing your job, you've lost your network, you've lost your coworkers, you've lost the people that you organize with in independent labor organizing. So that creates more obstacles to get across when you're, you know, to jump across when you're trying to organize. And then the other thing that you really need in order to organize is safe spaces. And as we've seen with the FBI raids, is my anti-war cell safe? You know, there was in Minneapolis, they had an informant in their midst for 3 years. So, you know, we're sort of under attack, if not purposely, then at least that is the consequence of the way that our society is sort of structured right now. And the sort of actions of the government by coming after activists. You know, on the one hand, we're being fragmented by our workplaces being destroyed, and then the places that we organize are being fragmented by the FBI and the informants.
Let me say something. I would like to retire with a pretty decent pension and live in a small roadhouse, you know, in the middle of the forest. And I don't think it's going to happen. And I can be deported. My citizenship, U.S. citizenship, can be taken away from me. I can be deported, and I can be thrown in jail, and I can end up my life living in Cuba, not this good side of Cuba, but in Guantanamo. That's my reality. And I decided that I'll risk it and I'll go for it. And that's exactly what we have to do all over, and that I don't see many people willing to do that. Let's strike. Let's call for a general strike in the United States. I get pissed when I hear people thinking that May Day is Immigrants' Day. No, it's not. That's International Workers' Day, and it was born here in Chicago by immigrants, yeah, sure, in 1886, and brought back to Chicago by immigrants, sure, but it's Workers' Day. Let's strike. Not on May Day because it's Sunday, but let's strike on May 2nd. Let's call for a general strike. Can we do that? I'm going to be thrown in jail because that's going to be called terrorism. Yeah, April 15th. If you are due a tax return, declare. If you are not, postpone it. Ask for an extension. Can we call for a general tax strike? It's going to cost us personally and socially, and well, who's going to risk it? Who's willing to risk it? I think that's one of the major questions here. Do we have enough people in all of our social networks willing to go that way? That's big question. If you want to retire with a good pension in a roadhouse, you are not going to be there with us. But if you're willing to risk it, let's go do it. Oh, well, that's the other one. There's not going to be pension anyway.
I just wanted to two questions. One, for Mr. Deutsch, what do you think the current situation in terms of the grand juries means for the at least the immediate future of the anti-war movement here in the United States? And for Mr. Mujica, what is your sense of where the immigrant rights movement stands, particularly in relation to the mobilization that sort of young people have pushed forward in calling for the DREAM Act?
Okay, we have
a
two-part question. Of course, the use of the grand jury creates a chilling effect on anti-war, all activism, because anybody who's involved in political protests can be targeted and called before a grand jury. So it does threaten people who are concerned about being called before a grand jury and then having to become an informant against their movement or go to jail. So it is a threat. And hopefully people will continue and have continued to do the work that's necessary to expose the U.S. government and their role all over the world. And the fight back, which we're seeing against the grand jury, gives people power and encourages them.
I think the DREAM Act campaign was one of the most beautiful campaigns I have seen. They did all of the right things, sit-ins, hunger strikes, taking over the president of the Senate, well, the majority leader of the Senate offices, and they did it all for the wrong cause. That's the only problem. You know, it's a brilliant campaign, a very decided campaign. They put everything in risk. They risked everything. They went to jail, and they did it for the wrong law. And that's one of the problems, again, we face. That's the kind of campaign I would like to see, but for the right reasons, not for the reasons the Democrats and the Republicans play you with. Yeah. you know, yeah, okay, so let's do this and let's do that and let's put it up for a vote. Yeah, and we're going to lose the vote. Yeah, we're going to lose the vote. Who cares? Yeah. So that was the wrong bill, but it was the right campaign. And that's the kind of campaigns I would like to see, but for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons.
Okay. I had a question for Michael Deutsch, and then maybe a general sort of comment about organizing. Maybe some of this you've answered a little, but I was wondering, so what sort of political levers do we have against the overuse of the grand jury system on the one hand, or, you know, against the broad use of the label of terrorism? Do we, you know, I think of Howard Zinn's comment from, I think when Justice Roberts was appointed, he wrote an article saying it's not up to the court in the long run, it's the people that determine what the standards are and not what the courts end up following the people instead of the other way around. But that's what he takes a very long view.
Yeah, I don't think we have a lot of avenues within the law, unfortunately. Once somebody's subpoenaed to a grand jury and given immunity, it's very difficult to keep them out of jail unless if they're not going to testify. I think the strongest thing we have is people power, and people in the streets are protesting and, you know, doing civil disobedience or refusing to testify, and some people will go to jail, but in the end they won't get the information that they seek and they'll back off, and that's what's happened in the past. But there will be people who will go to jail for refusing to testify. But if people just give in to it and just go ahead and testify, not only do they become informants, but they provide the government with, you know, more impetus to go after other people. So you have to draw the line and just say, I'm not going to do it. And people have to be brave and resist. That's what it's about. That's what he's saying it's about, and it is about resistance.
Could I ask about that? And is there anything that we can do to support people who are taking that sort of risk? Besides saying, you know, we sympathize with you, you know, we'll keep your cats?
Well, what you can do is be out there when there's demonstrations, and you can write, you know, letters protesting to the U.S. Attorney and to the Attorney General and to the media, and just make a public issue out of it. That's what I think you can do. Go ahead.
stopfbi.net, and they have a plethora of things plus your own ideas about what can be done. A conference last week said that if the three people that are going to be recalled to the grand jury get a date, there will be another mobilization.
Right.
Last had 50 cities, but and there were other plans made, too. Again, you can get all this at stopfbi.net.
I did have another thing that I wanted to say. I heard about this. It's a biological analogy that I heard about just during the time of the Egyptian demonstrations about bacterial communication. So a biologist who's studying how tiny little bacteria manage to be effective, dangerous against the overwhelming immune system of their host, realized that bacteria, apparently most kinds of bacteria, are continually sending out signals, chemical signals that are specific to their type of bacterium, that their peers sense, and they use them to determine, you know, how many of their peers there are in the neighborhood, and bacteria will switch behaviors depending on how concentrated they are. So pathogenic bacteria will exist in the gut, on the skin, but lie low until they realize that there's a quorum. It's called quorum sensing. There's all kinds of behaviors that switch. So she talks about luminescent bacteria. It's pretty cool. But one of the things that her group is working on is an alternate kind of antibiotic that, rather than killing the bacteria, which yields strong selection pressure, you know, and so if any survive, then the whole population becomes full of resistant bacteria. Instead of that, she wants to interfere with quorum sensing, in effect, to convince the bacteria that they're scarce, even if they aren't. And so they'll remain harmless.
Cool.
Yes.
Yes.
This is what the media system has figured out how to do with us, to convince ourselves that we are, you know, sparse and harmless. So, and I don't know what we can do with that, but I thought, but somehow, you know, the people of Egypt managed to evade that barrier. So, yeah, I'll hand over the microphone to who's next? Go, Jake.
Actually, it was a really quick question for Jorge. You mentioned that criminals were being deported, and I was just wondering if it's before they are actually convicted of the crime, so they don't even go through the justice system, they're automatically, if they're being picked up for like drugs or for sex abuse or something like that, then they're automatically taken out of the court system and deported. Is that the situation, or do they go through the court system, then they're convicted, then they're deported?
No, there's a two-tier system for immigrants. Even if you obtain the U.S. citizenship, there are certain offenses that are qualify you as immediately deportable. So if you committed the offense and, you know, the trial started against you and then you jump bail and et cetera, you're a fugitive, then there's no need to finish the procedure. They just deport you and that's it. Domestic violence, you know, stuff like that. It's immediately deportable. It doesn't matter, regardless of your status. Pretty much, if you are an undocumented immigrant, you don't get to see an immigration judge unless you really request it. And the pressure for you not to request it is immense. The immigration agents convince you that you better sign your voluntary deportation or voluntary departure, either or, because if you want to see a judge, you're going to have to stay like 6 months in jail until you see the judge. And you know how bad jails are, so you don't want to do that, so you better sign. And, you know, there's a lot of this pressure put into people. So we have managed so far to let the community know that you have the right to see a judge. And maybe because of the increased number of arrests and detentions and whatever, the rate of deportations denied by immigration judges has gone up. So now, as stupid as it may sound, the more people immigration is detaining, the more people we are able to legalize. It's stupid, but you cannot open your case, your immigration case. You can't request a legalization. But if you are detained by immigration, your case is opened. So you can go to the judge, you know, resist the pressure to sign your deportation, go to the judge, and in one of three cases, people are staying here. In one of three cases, immigration judges are denying the deportation requested by immigration. It's stupid, but that's the way it is.
For Jorge, so I just wanted to understand, okay, in 2006, et cetera, we had a lot of immigrant rallies and pro-immigration, and you said the DREAM Act protesters, they did everything right. So please try to, I'm not understanding, what should they have done differently? Or was it, it doesn't seem like it was a matter of how, it seemed like a what. So could you be a little bit more prescriptive on what? And just the other thing generally for the panel is that it seems like it's so easy, a lot of the people in this room are of like minds, but it seems like it's so easy to be reactionary in tough times like this. Just look at the 2010 election. So how do we convince our neighbors or the folks in the suburbs or whoever that, you know, we're all in this together and not the divide and conquer type of thing as we've been seeing? Thanks.
I guess I'll answer first. Pretty quick, the failed history of the immigration movement is that after May Day 2006, when millions of people marched, you know, all over the United States, the organizations, what we call now the corporations in the immigration movement, were convinced by the Democratic Party that the only way out it was to elect a Democratic majority. In November 2006, we did elect a Democratic majority for the House, and then in 2008, a Democratic majority in both houses, and we gave them the White House. I think that was the problem of the immigration movement, that instead of continuing marching and doing direct actions to push a change, you know, all these people were convinced that the way was to elect Democrats into power, and that's it. And ever since, the immigration movement broke up, and we have all the corporations systematically insisting that the way out is voting Democrat, 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 becoming U.S. citizen if you are a legal resident, and forget about marching, forget about strike, forget about boycotts, forget about any direct action. And the DREAM Act plays into this. Last year, we had the upper hand. An initiative was presented in the House of Representatives, which it was bad, actually, but it was an initiative that would have legalized probably 8 million people or something like that on the good side. On the bad side, it was bad. But on the good side, it would have legalized maybe 8 million people. We had a 200,000 people or quarter of a million people demonstration in Washington, D.C. The day the health reform was approved, that day we had a quarter million people marching in Washington, D.C. for immigration reform. And day on May Day, we had the largest demonstrations since 2007, and we had the upper hand. But somebody gave the order, stop it. Stop it because, you know, we are in trouble and we are not going to be touching immigration this year. That someone was somebody that, unfortunately, if you live in the city of Chicago, it's going to be your mayor, Rahm Emanuel. He stopped it all. And these corporations in the immigration movement fell into that line and said, okay, we're stopping everything. And the students, the undocumented students and youth, not necessarily students, but young people, got pissed, mildly pissed. And they decided to go for the DREAM Act. And they were played.
That was a section of that larger comprehensive immigration
law. That's correct. The DREAM Act is would have legalized maybe 200,000 young people, you know, up to 35 years old, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is that they did it out of being pissed by the order to stop everything, stop mobilizations, stop marching, stop everything. And they radicalized and they did it. But the only thing they could do it for, it was this very bad proposal to legalize these 200,000 people on the condition that you pay your college for 2 years, or you join the army, and you know you get 6 years conditional residence, blah blah blah. So it was a pretty bad bill, and the Democrats put it up for a vote, knowing that they were going to lose, and the students went along with it, and then they lost the election, and then they put it up for a vote again, and they lost the vote again. So the Democrats used it to play with the students and to stop all those direct actions, you know, also as a way to recover, to recapture the Latino vote, which is all, you know, the Latino communities fed up and disappointed with the Democrats and the Democratic administration and Obama and everything else. And that's also politically risky. Either Latinos go with Republicans in 2012, or they stay at home, but they are not going to vote Democrats. That's why we are organizing the tequila party. And maybe we will change it to the bacteria party. It's a good idea. But we do need urgently an alternative. Otherwise, people are going to stay home or vote Republican.
I'm
Well, I think this is a corollary to Andy's point, because I think the problem, Jorge's been very honest about how channeling the immigrant rights movement into voting, today we march, tomorrow we vote, bullshit, just completely undermined it. But I think there's a corollary to the sort of organizational independence, which is a political independence, where the immigrant rights movement never addressed the question of the war. And many of us here were out at the immigrant rights march, but you didn't see the anti-war movement really taking up that struggle and seeing, well, this whole war on terror is really a war of terror, and it's the empire destroying these people's homes, countries, that's driving them here, and are we actually addressing these struggles from the perspective of humanity as a whole? Or are we each in our own little silos? And don't, because one of the things that Democratic Party affiliation does is you don't risk talking about the war, or you're going to lose your contacts in the legislature or whatever. But there's a political and ideological component that goes with the organizational component. And if even, you know, third party candidacies can bring with it all that same baggage. You know, and if we don't expand the resistance to that broader perspective, I don't see where we're not gonna just gonna, well, and I just wanted to add, the same could be said with the anti-war movement, mm-hmm. where I know some of us who were marching in October of 2008 up on Devon were trashed by the people who were going to register voters in Wisconsin and Iowa, right. because we weren't really fighting the war if we weren't, you know, that kind of mentality. Has got to be actually broken down and analyzed and broken with.
Well, I was going to respond to what your comment was. You know, I belong to CAMI, and we've always put those issues together. That's always been our view, okay? And unfortunately, the young man that left here about the DREAM Act, we've always opposed the DREAM Act for that specific reason on the military component of it. And I agree with Mojica, you know, the immigration movement was co-opted by the politicians. And I think these are lessons that we need to write now. We need to address it to the young people to really understand what really happened and not to fall into the same mistakes. Because what I see currently happening is because of the DREAM Act movement. You know, the kids are united now, but there's also a division now. Because there are undocumented kids who feel like their issue is more important than working class youth, right. okay? Yes. And that is going on right now. Mm-hmm. And that's dividing the immigration movement, mm-hmm. which it's a serious issue right now. So that's something I wish Mojica would answer. How do we go forward in terms of reuniting all youth, all working class people, everybody in the anti-war movement to really take on this issue? Because it affects us all.
What we have been trying to do for 2 or 3 years now is to declassify the immigration movement as an immigration movement and qualify it as a workers' movement, that's it. So a workers' movement that is related to public transportation, public education, housing, you know, job security, health care and health services, and blah, 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 blah. And saying, well, yeah, we also need papers. But it's an also. It's not a first thing, first priority. But we have found a lot of resistance from all of the other movements. I repeat, May Day is Immigrants' Day. And nobody marches on Immigrants' Day if you're not an immigrant. Or if you're not an anarchist, because anarchists have always been with us. But other than anarchists, nobody marches on May Day.
Some communists.
And yeah, some communists too. But that's been part of the struggle, you know, to re-identify the immigration movement with all of the other movements. Rich, but you're right. Labor organizations are not moving. Not on May Day and not on anything else. You know, it's Wisconsin is an exception because they felt incredibly really directly attacked. But here in the city of Chicago, the immigration movement is being opposed by most of the trade unions. Only the service unions, who have a lot of immigrants as members, are sort of addressing the issue. But I would say 50% of the labor movement is not with the immigration movement, period. And they don't like us, and they don't identify with us.